It is very humbling to think, isn't it, of the history of our land, the blessings that we've had as a nation down through the centuries. And this morning, as we remember the 100 years since the first signing of the armistice on the 11th of November 1918, it's good for us to reflect, isn't it, and to think back, on and remember those who whose commitment and sacrifice was so great, and those that still serve in the forces for our defence. And it's humbling, isn't it, to think of how different things could have been. We remember their sacrifice this morning. We remember their commitment. But we also remember God's mercy to us through all this time. On the 24th of May, 1940, King George VI called the nation to prayer. The nation responded. You can still see footage of queues of people trying to get into churches in order to join in a time of prayer. Just 2 months later, saw the commencement of the Battle of Britain. And who can doubt God's intervention during that time? On the 3rd of September, just a few days after the beginning of the Second World War, King George VI went on air on the radio to give a speech, and towards the end of that speech, he said this: "The task will be hard. There may be dark days ahead, and war can no longer be confined to the battlefield. But we can only do the right as we see the right, and reverently commit our cause to God. If one and all we keep resolutely faithful to it, ready for whatever service or sacrifice it may demand, then with God's help, we shall prevail. May He bless and keep us all." That was a prayer. And we believe that God answered that prayer. And there are many instances, surely, during the Second World War when that intervention can be seen, no less in Dunkirk and other circumstances that seem to be hopeless. We do believe that God answered prayer. We believe it was right for the king to call the nation to prayer. But you do have to wonder what would happen today if our sovereign did the same. We have fallen so far away spiritually. But we thank God for his intervention. We thank him for the deliverance that through the sacrifice of so many was given to this nation. We have been delivered from what the king termed the primitive doctrine that might is right. And we should be thankful for that. Well, we're going to read from the New Testament now. The reading's found on page 851 in the Church Bible. That's Mark's Gospel, chapter 14. Mark's Gospel, chapter 14, and we're beginning to read at verse 43. And immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12. And with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and scribes and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." And when he came, he went up to him at once and said, "Rabbi," and he kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled. And they all left him and fled. And a young man followed him, with nothing but a linen cloth about his body. And they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even about this their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?' But he remained silent and made no answer. Again the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' And Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his garments and said, 'What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?' And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.' And the guards received him with blows." Well, if you have a Bible near, perhaps you could open it in the passage that we read on page 851, Mark's Gospel, chapter 14. I'm told that 16 prime ministers of Great Britain can trace their ancestry back to just one man. You may have heard of Sir George Villiers. He was an Elizabethan squire, very friendly with royalty and very favoured. But it's interesting that 16 prime ministers, including William Pitt the elder and William Pitt the younger and Anthony Eden and Winston Churchill and David Cameron, they can all trace their ancestry back to that man. I think they call that nepotism, don't they? Jobs for the boys. Keep it in the family. Favouring those that are near to us. Well, that's something that's found all over the world, isn't it? And through all generations, in every society where there are things like this go on. And in Palestine, in the time of the Lord Jesus, that was going on then as well. One family dominated the scene for over 50 years in Israel. It all started with Annas, the high priest. He was priest for a number of years, and then when he died, his son Eleazar took over. Then for 18 years, Caiaphas became high priest. He was his son-in-law. And then after him, four more sons, including Annas the younger, was one of them. Four other sons took over and became high priest. They were a very powerful family at that time. They were the religious leaders in Israel during all of this time. But when we think of religious leaders, I don't know what you think of normally, but perhaps when we think of the high priest, in the as it's written here in the New Testament, we kind of, I don't know about you, I conjure up in my mind very often, you know, the Archbishop of Canterbury or somebody like that, you know, the Pope, whatever it might be. Don't think along those lines at all. Because this was more like the mafia. To fall foul of one of this family meant you were in big trouble. And that's exactly where Jesus is standing now. He's on trial for his life in the courts of the high priest. And you notice there in verse 53, it says, "And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together." This was a massive gathering. And it was a gathering that spelt, of course, the end, the crucifixion of our Lord Jesus Christ. He is like a lamb among the wolves right now. And there are three things that I want to just learn very quickly from this passage this morning. I want to see, first of all, the treachery of Judas in verses 43 to 50. And then, secondly, I want to see the trial of Jesus in verses 53 to verse 65. But then also just a word at the end about the triumph of truth. So let's start with the treachery of Judas. Look at verse 43. It says, "And immediately while he was still speaking," while there they are in Gethsemane, and Jesus has been praying and he's been asking the Lord, "Lord, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me." And as he's still speaking, it says, "Judas comes." Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now, the interesting thing about this passage is that Mark doesn't mention many names. You go down to verse 47 and you notice the way he writes here. It's very interesting. But in verse 47 he says, "But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." Mark doesn't tell us who this was. He just sort of leaves it hanging. And Mark's gospel, of course, was the first. Historically, it was the first gospel to be written. So for a number of years, it was probably talked about quite a lot. Well, who was it? Who was this one that drew out his sword and struck off the ear of the high priest, or the servant of the high priest? Well, we know, don't we now, from the other gospels, of course, that he's talking about Peter. But Mark doesn't mention that. He doesn't mention the name of the servant of the high priest. John does. So John tells us in his gospel that his name was Malchus. And you have to wonder whether perhaps he's named there because Malchus became a Christian, perhaps later, and was added to the church. So he's named because people would know him now. Maybe that's the case. We can't really be sure about that. But again, Mark doesn't mention his name here. And then look at verse 51. It's intriguing, isn't it? "And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked." Well, he doesn't tell us again who that is, does he? It's probably Mark himself. This is probably Mark's cameo appearance in the gospel. I don't know if you've watched Hitchcock films. I'm sure you have at some stage. But of course, Hitchcock has got a little bit of a mark in his films, hasn't he? And of course, you know that he always appears in his films, and it's part of the fun of watching the film is to be able to spot him, you know, when he has his walk-on part. And I don't think he ever says a word, does he? And then he walks away again, but there is Hitchcock appearing in his own film. Well, this is kind of Mark's, just a little note. But it's his way of saying, "I was there. I saw it all happen." And tradition tells us that Mark's mother was a wealthy lady, and she owned what was the upper room. And Mark, as a young teenager, probably, would have witnessed the Last Supper and would have heard the words that were being said. He knew that something was happening. And so when they go out to the Mount of Olives, what happens? Well, he just grabs a linen cloth and he goes out and he has to follow. He follows from a distance, but there he is, and he's seeing all of this going on, and he's seeing Gethsemane, and now when the arrest takes place, they even grab him. But he just escapes by the skin of his teeth. But Mark is basically saying there in verse 51, "I was there. I saw it with my own eyes. I heard it with my own ears. I'm not lying. These things are true." But he doesn't mention his name. The only name that he mentions there from verses 43 to 51 is the name of Judas. Someone has quite rightly said, people call their children Peter, Mary, James, Joanna. They call their dogs Caesar and Nero. But no one ever calls anyone Judas, not even their dogs. Why? Because of course, everything that is associated now with the name Judas. That name is reserved for our enemies, isn't it? Those that betray us. But it's interesting the way that Mark talks about Judas here. You notice how he says it in verse 43. Immediately while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, he says. One of the 12. Now that's interesting because nearly every time that Judas is mentioned in the Gospels, nearly every time this phrase comes after his name. One of the 12. It's almost like his tag, his identifying feature. But then you notice in the very next verse, in verse 44, you notice that now how he describes him. He says, now the betrayer had given them a sign. He's simply known now as the betrayer. Have you ever been betrayed? Maybe a husband or a wife or a parent or a pastor. Someone perhaps who you trusted. Someone perhaps who you shared a confidence with. But in the end they gave that confidence up. That hurts, doesn't it? Even if it is just a small word that perhaps isn't too significant. Whenever we're betrayed, it just hurts, doesn't it? It's a terrible experience to go through. But this is 1,000 times worse than that, isn't it? And he does so with a kiss, verse 44. And the word there is emphatic. In other words, he gave him a hearty kiss. This was the kiss of death from Judas, wasn't it? It was the identifying mark so that the crowd that had come with him would know exactly who he was in the dark. There they are, it's dark in Gethsemane. Well, who is it? They didn't want to make any mistakes here. They had to be absolutely sure that they got the right man. And so Judas identifies him this way with a hearty kiss. And then they take hold of him and they lead him away. But what does this story tell us? What does it teach us? Surely the betrayal of Judas ought to give us pause for thought, at least, didn't it? Who is Judas? He's one of the 12. In 1965, ATV, at the time, I think it's called ITV now, of course, but ATV, in 1965, made a very short program, a very short documentary by the name of A Face for Judas. And it was the story of a producer who wanted to find an actor who would be able to portray and play the part of Judas in an up-and-coming film. Michael Jeans, who was the producer, searched high and low, all over the country, for the right actor to take this part. He looked at all sorts of faces. He was looking for a particular face. And he went through all of these different actors, and he looked everywhere he possibly could. And he couldn't find anyone. And the story, the documentary just finishes with Michael Jeans just passing a mirror. And he looked into a mirror and he simply said, you'll do. You'll do. We need to remember that. One of the 12. One of the 12. A church member. Probably a deacon or an elder or a pastor even. He's one of the 12. He's a leader, isn't he? He's one of the apostles. And we need to remember that. We need to take warning from this story, from this passage, don't we? Christians, we very often, don't we? We talk about assurance of salvation. Good. We should. The New Testament tells us that we can have assurance of salvation, and it's good to know it. We ought to know it. The first letter of John is all about assurance, and he writes to so that we'll have it, he says. But those of us who are, let's say, of the Reformed and perhaps Calvinistic persuasion, we have the tendency to use words like once saved, always saved, don't we? That's not what Calvin taught. That's not what the Reformed faith actually teaches. The teaching is actually the perseverance of the saints, and that's not the same thing. And the point of what I'm trying to make here is simply this. Assurance is not based on assumptions. It's not based on the fact that we may have had an experience in the past and that now we're depending on that experience, and because we've had that experience, I must be saved. We're not to simply assume, or even simply because we regularly attend church. You know, we could be sitting in here. Judas would have been here. He's one of the 12. That kind of assumption can be deadly. Why was it that Judas gave him away? Why was it that he betrayed him in the way that he did? Well, I'm pretty sure it didn't happen overnight. These things never do. 6 months before the cross, if you'd have asked Judas whether he was determined to betray Jesus and whether he was going to hand him over, I'm sure he would have been absolutely astounded. He would have been shocked and horrified at the thoughts. Where was Judas 6 months before the cross? Well, he was out preaching the kingdom with all the other 11, wasn't he? Jesus sent them out on missions. And there he was. He was doing what everybody else did. That's why none of them could point the finger in the Last Supper, saying it must be him. They were all asking, is it me? Is it me that's going to betray you? Why? Because they didn't see a difference, did they? He had experienced so much when you think about it. He'd done it all. But Peter says in the New Testament, doesn't he? Make your calling and election sure. Don't just assume. Make sure of your salvation. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, if we judge ourselves, we will not be judged. You see? He's saying if you insist that, well, you're just going to sort of take it all for granted anyway, you're not going to judge yourself. Well, no. We're to judge ourselves. We're to examine ourselves, says Paul, to see if we're in the faith. Don't just assume it. He was one of the 12, and yet he was a thief, wasn't he? He'd heard all the preaching of Jesus for 3 years. Nobody ever taught like this man. And Judas was there all the time. He'd heard the preaching and how powerful it must have been. He'd seen the miracles. He was there in the boat when Jesus calmed the storm. He was there when he raised the dead. He was there when he gave the blind their sight and so on. He saw it all. He knew these things were true. He'd seen the miracles, and yet he's living a double life. And probably, bit by bit, he allows his conscience to be hardened and finally seared so that he becomes totally insensitive to the gospel and to the overtures of grace, even in the Lord's Supper. He becomes hard and harder still until he's just cut off, until he can't hear. And there's a warning there for us, isn't there? Let me put it this way. It's like the traffic lights. You notice when you drive towards some traffic lights, they go from green, amber, red. The other way around, it's a bit different, isn't it? Because it's red and amber at the same time, saying, get ready, but don't go yet. Now it's green, you're okay. But in the other direction, it's green, amber, red. What do you do when you see the amber lights? You put your foot down. and try and beat the lights. I remember there was an ad on the telly, and I think it was in the 60s or 70s. But the motto of the advert was, "Don't be an amber gambler." Remember that one? Don't be an amber gambler. And that's what Judas is telling us here. That's what this story is really all about. Don't gamble with your soul. Don't gamble with your soul. Be sure. Make sure. Make your calling and election sure. Examine yourself to see if you're in the faith. Not examine your faith to see if it's good enough. It's not that. Are you in the faith? That's the question. Are you trusting in the Saviour? And not just in the past, some time long ago, you know, an experience. Are you trusting Him now? Is He your only hope? If today was your last day on earth, if tomorrow you were before the judgment seat, what would your hope, what is your hope? That I went to church all my life, I did this, I did that, I was a pretty good person maybe, I was an evangelical, I stood in the pulpit and preached the gospel, you know. Is that our hope? Is that your hope? No! What is your only hope? It must be Jesus and His death on the cross for you. That's all, isn't it? Are you trusting Jesus now? That's the point. Are you repenting now? Or do we try? We go through our lives perhaps just trying to justify our sin and blame other people or our circumstances or our past. That's what we do, isn't it? Very often we just try and excuse ourselves. We try and find justification for what we do. Or are we repenting? That's the question. That's all that matters, isn't it? Don't be an amber gambler. Make sure that you are in the faith. That you are saved. Make sure today. But what about the trial of Jesus? From verse 53 onwards. You notice in verse 53 it says, "And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together." The commentators estimate, and the historians, they estimate that there probably would have been around 70 big chiefs gathered together on that occasion. Everyone who was anyone in the religious scene would have been there. They'll give him a fair trial, won't they? They'll give him a fair trial. Look at verse 55. "Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death." What happened to innocent until proven guilty? This is a setup. They're looking for evidence to put him to death. In other words, it's all fixed, isn't it? The whole thing's a farce. You know, we sometimes say, don't we, when a question is in doubt, we say, "Oh, the jury's out on that one." The jury's not out on this. The jury's already been out and come back in again. They've got the verdict ready. They want to condemn. They're looking for a reason to condemn him to death. They've made their decision. All they want to do now is justify it. And so much is wrong about this trial of the Lord Jesus Christ. A capital offence was never to be tried at night, according to Jewish law. Never, but this one is at night. The sentence was never to be passed on the same day, but this one is. Or not the same night in that case. When witnesses couldn't agree, the case was to be thrown out immediately, according to Jewish law. And according to Jewish law, the accused could never be condemned simply on his own testimony. And you read through this passage and all four of those laws in Israel were just thrown out of the window, weren't they? Because they're absolutely determined. They've made their decision and they're just looking for the reason in order to justify it. The whole thing's a farce and it is unanimous. You notice there, down at the bottom there in verse 64... towards the end of the passage in verse 64, "You have heard his blasphemy," said the high priest. "What is your decision?" And they all condemned him as deserving death. Jesus is on trial. And he still is. They had to make their minds up that night about Jesus. Do you know you have to make your mind up as well? Did you realize that? Every single one of us does. And the point of this passage now is that we're all there as well. We're all there. I know I was. Before I was a Christian, I was an atheist, and whenever any Christians try to talk to me about the gospel, well, because my name is Thomas, all my friends call me Doubting Thomas, because I would argue and argue until I was blue in the face. I thought I knew so much. I thought I knew it all. Oh, we've discovered evolution now. You know, we don't believe in all of that stuff. We don't believe in that rubbish. And I thought I knew everything. And I was so bold and so knowing, I thought. And there I was trying to argue my case and didn't really know a thing. But really, when I think about it, you know, I was there. I was sitting in the court with the high priest. And isn't that where we all are, naturally? That's what unbelief is, isn't it? You talk to people these days, and what is it? Everybody knows. We've all got our opinions. We're all so sure that we know the truth. And we've discovered this, and we've discovered that, and so on. But the Bible, the scripture, that's how it speaks of unbelief. You remember how it describes it in the first chapter of the book of Romans. He says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse." He's describing unbelief there, isn't he? He says the truth is plain to them. The things of God have been clearly perceived. They can understand these things. It's not that they don't understand. But why don't men believe then? Well, he tells us in verse 18. We want to suppress the truth. And that's what people do. That's what I did. That's what so many people are doing. We want to suppress the truth. And the picture there is very telling, isn't it? It's like when you're going on a holiday and you've only got so much space in your suitcase, but you've got more stuff that you want to take. You know what it's like. You keep shoving it in and sitting on it, don't you? And trying to do the zip a little bit more and trying to get everything that you possibly can into the case. That's the picture, really, in that verse. We suppress the truth. We push it down. We want to put a lid on it. We don't want to face it, so we'll put a lid on it to make it quiet. And isn't that what we see here in the trial of Jesus? These are intelligent people. These are the educated of the society in Israel. And yet, you look in verse 65, it says, "And some began to spit on him and cover his face and strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.'" That's the chief priests and the scribes. He hasn't even been handed over to the guards yet. That's what they're doing, these intelligent people. And you have to ask, well, why? Why is that the case? Why do people do this? At the end of the service, not just yet, but in the end of the service, in a few moments, we're going to sing the last hymn, 215, and it's a very familiar one to us, I'm sure. But I wonder if you realise that there's actually a verse missing in our Bible, in our hymn book, rather. There's actually a verse missing. It's a long hymn, so I guess they just had to choose. But the missing verse says this: "Why? What hath my Lord done? What makes this rage and spite? He made the lame to run. He gave back the blind their sight. Sweet injuries. Yet they themselves displease and 'gainst him rise." Sweet injuries, he says. He made the lame run and the blind. He gave back their sight. sweet injuries. And for this, they put him to death. For this, they take offense. The whole thing's a farce, and it still is. We don't understand, you know, the power of unbelief. We don't get it. We like to think that we've got the intellect to be able to decipher and to know without any prejudice. I remember hearing the story of one evangelist who was speaking to to a man, a friend of his, about the gospel, and he was adamant that he didn't believe, and kept on coming back with argument after argument and so on, and until the evangelist simply said, look, hang on a minute, hang on. Just for one moment, he said, let me ask you, try and strip back all of your prejudices, your preconceived ideas, and what you've been taught and what you believe and so on. He said, look at verse 61, and he used this passage. In verse 61, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And the evangelist said to his friend, just for one moment, if you take away all your prejudices, would you not admit that that is at least possible? That is at least possible that God walked on this earth and his name was Jesus? And his friend, in a moment of honesty, opened up and said, well, that would be very inconvenient if that were true. Inconvenient, said the evangelist. Why inconvenient? Well, his friend said, if that is true, my life has to change. Exactly, said the evangelist. Exactly. That's why Jesus was condemned. Because he exposed their hypocrisy. He threatened their position and their interests. He demanded change. And they're not willing to allow that to happen. And if you're not a Christian this morning, let me just tell you, that's why you don't believe. You may not realize it, but that's really why you don't believe. Not because you're unconvinced, but because it's inconvenient. We don't want him to judge us, so we think we're going to judge him. That's not going to happen. We justify ourselves, and so we dismiss him without a second thought. Are you the Christ? The Son of the Blessed One? Are you the Son of God? I am, says Jesus. Deal with it. That's true. You need to ask questions, don't you, if that's true? And you need to make sure you're on the right side now, don't you? That may be very inconvenient, but if it's true, that's the question you need to ask. If it's true, then you've got to do something about it. So let me just close with a third point very, very briefly. The triumph of truth. You see what Jesus says there in verse 62. Jesus said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated on the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. What's Jesus saying there? Well, in a way, you could say he's, of course, talking to the high priest. He's talking to his judge. And he's saying, you think you've written me off? This isn't the end. We're going to meet again. But that time, the tables will be turned. When is Jesus speaking of? Well, surely he's speaking of the second coming, when he comes to judge the living and the dead. It may have been partially fulfilled in the resurrection and the ascension and the coming of the Spirit in Pentecost. But I can't help but believe that Jesus is looking forward to that great day when he returns as judge of all the world. I'm reminded of the tour guide in the art gallery who was showing the spectators, showing the viewers around the paintings in the art gallery and explaining this and that about the paintings. And all the time he was conscious that there were a couple of men in the crowd, in the group. A couple of them were just laughing and sniggering and poking fun and weren't appreciating the art and just having a bit of a laugh about it all and scorning what they viewed as bad art. He said nothing for a while until he came to the end, and just at the end, when he was showing them the last room, he said, "Can I remind you that it's not the artists that are being judged here, it's the viewers." Because that man was just exposing his own ignorance, wasn't he? Well, they were exposing their own ignorance. They didn't understand what they were looking at. And that's what we need to see here in this passage at the end. What we need to remember. You don't get to judge Jesus. Jesus is going to judge you. We haven't got that right. We think we do. People doing it all the time. But he is our judge. We are not his. And one day, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So you better get on side. Repent and believe the gospel. You better do it now, because on that day it will be too late.